Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And let me tell you a little bit about our next guest. Holding Bachelor of Science degrees in Chemistry and Human Biology and a Doctorate in Chiropractic, Amir A. Rashidian is the founder of the Mid-Atlantic Chiropractic Centers. Established in 2006 and serving over 20,000 patient visits annually in two locations, the Mid-Atlantic Chiropractic Centers focus on high-tech diagnostics to detect and correct disturbances in the nervous system. The doctors at the Mid-Atlantic Chiropractic Centers promoting drugless health solutions work with patients to eliminate the causes of disease and not merely the suppression of symptoms. As a consultant, Dr. Rashidian has worked with 18 chiropractic practices, 16 of which were startup businesses that all reached profitability within the first 3 months of a business launch. Dr. Rashidian attributes his success in opening practices to an intensive, systematized marketing plan implemented 3 months prior to big business launch. He has personally opened two very successful chiropractic practices. A very active speaker at corporate events, conventions, and churches, he is also frequently interviewed by the local TV, radio, and newspaper. Additionally, Dr. Rashidian served for 6 years on the board of directors of Habitat for Humanity and is a major financial supporter of their local building projects. Furthermore, Dr. Rashidian also serves as a chairman of the elder leadership team at Grace Community Church in Frederick, Maryland. He has won multiple honors and awards, including Business Leader of the Year and Philanthropist of the Year. He has been happily married since 2005, and together they have 3 sons. And Amir, I kind of figure in between all that you do, you probably get some time for sleep.
Enough, yes.
That's good. And welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I've been looking forward to our conversation for some time, particularly since we met on LinkedIn, and the fact that you believe in functional medicine and looking at the root cause of issues as opposed to treating symptoms speaks very close to my heart, because that's a philosophy that I can align with.
Thank you very much. I've been looking forward to it as well. I'm honored to be with you.
And I'm honored to have you as a guest. So with that, I guess we might as well just get right down to the questions.
Yeah.
My first question is, tell our audience about the experiences or experiences that have shaped your life passions for chiropractic medicine and also for your work with stress management as well, too.
You know, I always wanted to be some type of doctor. I thought I wanted to be a surgeon, and that's the path I started with. And this came from growing up in Iran and seeing the underprivileged and impoverished areas of Iran. There were villages my father and I would go visit regularly. He would go bring them food or resources. He owned some land in those areas, and we'd go visit. And I just would see that. And I knew there were no doctors in some of those places, and people would die unnecessarily. So I thought it'd be great to be a doctor. And when I was 19, I was a student at George Washington University. I went home for Christmas break my sophomore year, and my father had this big, thick white neck brace on, and you could tell he was under the influence of some really heavy painkillers, and he had severe pain shooting down from his neck into his arms and hands. In fact, he couldn't pick up his arms to even give me a hug to say hello. Tremendous pain. So we spent my Christmas break that year going from doctor to doctor trying to figure out what is wrong with my dad. And every doctor we went to said, this is beyond my scope. You have to go to this other doctor. And finally, a neurosurgeon said, you need surgery. And he said, you needed surgery yesterday. We need to open you up. We need to slice you open from the base of the skull to the bottom of the neck. And what I'm going to do is break and remove the bones in the back of your spine to take pressure off the spinal cord. And it's pretty invasive. And he said, you know, because you're old, there's a chance you won't survive the surgery. Dad was 70 at the time. And, you know, there's such a thing as a young 70 and an old 70. He was the older type of 70. So it was risky. And we got in a taxi to go home. We talked to three neurosurgeons. We got a taxi to go home. The taxi driver looked at my dad and I in the rearview mirror. And at this point, I was very emotional because we were basically getting ready for this terrible surgery. And I didn't want to lose dad. And he saw the distress in my face. He saw my dad in a lot of pain sitting in the back of this taxi with his neck brace. And he said, listen, I know you asked me to take you home, but there's a chiropractor right down the street. Would you rather me take you there? I was a 19-year-old know-it-all. I said, no, we need to go home. We need to get ready for a surgery. Dad was terrified of the surgery, and he was wise. So he said, yes, let's try it. So we show up to this chiropractor's office. This office was under construction. It looked like a war zone. We walked in. There was dust and paint flying everywhere. There was no drywall. I mean, the place wasn't a full-fledged office. But there was the chiropractor in the back, and he ran up to the front. He introduced himself, and he brought one of those light boxes. You know, nowadays, x-rays are seen on computer screens. But back then, they were on film. Because we were coming from the neurosurgeon, I had all of dad's x-rays and MRIs and CT scans in my hand. And so he brought a light box and started reading the MRIs. And he said, listen, I can help you, but I'm not going to do it by breaking, removing bones in your spine. I'm not going to put metals and screws in your neck. And I will not have you on painkillers for the rest of your life. What I will do is gently, little by little, remove pressure from the nerves in the spinal cord using my hands. Your body will begin to self-heal and self-regulate. And that sounded like a foreign language to me. It didn't make any sense because my belief at the time was the only way to get better is drugs and surgery. But he looked right at me and he said, you know, your dad has these bone spurs growing into the spinal canal, narrowing the canal, and it's pressing on the spinal cord. And it's going to choke the life that flows from the brain to the rest of his body. And unless we find a way to decompress, this is not going to end well. I was so impressed because he told me exactly what the neurosurgeon had said. It's just his method of treatment was different. I was impressed because he could read those MRIs and accurately diagnose. And so dad got his first chiropractic adjustment right there and then. And he felt better for about a second. And then all his pain came back. But that alone gave him some hope. He had to go in about 6 days a week for the next 6 months. But at the end of the 6 months, dad walked in. And he was able to use his hands. He was able to turn his head. He had no pain. Dad lived another 18 years. He lived to be 88 years old. And at 88, he was younger than when he was 70. He was able to enjoy life, and I got to have him for an extra 18 years. He passed away in 2011. You said, what shapes my philosophy and passion for chiropractic and healthcare? It's this one thing, that when we suffer, everyone who cares about us suffers. Because when dad was sick, he wasn't the only one hurting. My mother suffered. I suffered. Everyone who cared about him suffered. And if I don't take care of my health, my three sons will suffer. My wife will suffer. I'm not doing it for me. See, a lot of people think taking care of yourself is selfish. I think taking care of yourself is a selfless act because you don't do it for you. You do it for everybody else around you. And not only that, it's really easy to let things go. It's easy to not work at your health. It's easy to just eat what you want, do what you want, lay around and let things just fall apart and then have other people take care of you. The hard part is getting up early and doing what it takes, doing it day in and day out consistently, having that reason for why you're doing it. So chiropractic is my method because I believe that the brain controls what happens in the body. Now, every thought, every emotion, every feeling, every action has a physiologic response in the body. And so how the brain controls the body is through the nerves that cross the spine. And so removing that interference seems to work very, very well. Also, we're going to dig deep into this as we talk, is the nervous system. You've got your voluntary nervous system, and then the involuntary nervous system has the sympathetic and parasympathetic branches. And if you can create balance between those two, your health will flourish. And that's where I specialize, is how to handle stress properly.
And, you know, for me, I know when I'm under stress and I'm under a lot of stress, I don't function properly. I don't think clearly. I don't feel as good physically. And I know that has a pervasive effect on mind, body, and even spirit. So I'm a firm believer in trying to engage in non-medical interventions to try to help find that balance. And I think, Amir, there's always a place for drugs and a place for surgery, but it's not the begin all, it's not the end all.
I agree.
And I think if we can take a look at integrative approaches and particular times where non-medical interventions are going to work better than medical interventions, why not? It proved to be the case for your father, who at 70 began to regain the fountain of youth just with non-medical, non-invasive procedures. And you're right. I think when we have a chronic illness or terminal illness or serious illness, it not only affects us, it affects those around us. And it impacts on our family members and friends' mood, their outlook, and particularly for individuals that have gone through invasive procedures in the last week of life, their family members are depressed or experience symptoms of depression for about 6 months after witnessing that. So anything that we can do in a selfless way to ensure that we're taking care of ourselves is going to be beneficial for all around us. So I really resonate with that philosophy as well.
Grief is a very real thing. It's very painful, and it is something that has massive physiologic impact on the body.
Can you tell our audience about how the stress of grief affects our body's physiology and what the long-term effects of if stress is unable to be managed properly?
You know, I look at grief like a bomb exploding in your home. It throws everything apart. It's devastating. It destroys things. And it leaves you trying to pick up pieces, and there's no motivation to pick up those pieces. You don't know if you'll ever be able to function again, be able to breathe, and everything's a chore. Will I ever laugh again? I don't even care at that point. It affects your mood. It affects your memory, ability to concentrate. It affects your appetite. It affects your energy levels. It affects how you sleep. It really wreaks havoc on everything. I use the analogy of a bomb exploding. I grew up in Iran where there was war. For my first 5 years of life, it was peaceful and beautiful. But then there was the big revolution and there were a lot of bombs falling and bullets flying through the streets. I know what anxiety feels like, but I think dealing with sudden grief or losing someone that you didn't expect to lose, it will wreak havoc on your whole system. So that bomb goes off, pupils dilate, right? Blood leaves your face, your hands and feet. So cold hands, cold feet, dry eyes, dry mouth, dry skin. Digestion slows down. So indigestion, constipation, heartburn, immune system drops. So some people get sick a lot easier at that point. And then you become hyper aware because you feel like you're being chased by a pack of hungry wolves. Saber-toothed tiger analogy, right? Now you can't sleep because the weirdest, silliest thoughts keep circulating through your brain over and over. You're laying down in your bed going, why can't I stop thinking about this? It's not even important and you can't fall asleep. And then when cortisol goes up, it affects brain centers, it affects your memory. So you forget, you become forgetful. You walk into the kitchen, you don't know why you're there. You go to the grocery store and you forget to bring your grocery list. You can't concentrate. People start talking to you and all of a sudden you go, what did you say? Repeat that, or I can't remember. It really does a whole lot of things. And then that cortisol response that also affects your circadian rhythm, because cortisol needs to be high in the morning, low at night. But if it doesn't go down, then you can't sleep either. And then it affects your blood sugar levels. So cortisol actually causes a release of sugar in your bloodstream, even if you're not eating sugar. But it creates these weird cravings. And we can certainly dig deep into that. The stages of stress have different food cravings. Initially, you may crave a lot of sugar, but that also depends because certain brain centers that get affected in grief affect your appetite in a negative way where you don't feel hungry. The biggest thing grief does, now I won't say it's the biggest thing, but one of the noticeable things is it eliminates your ability to experience pleasure from certain simple things like taste. Food that you liked before, they don't taste the same anymore. It's not good anymore. You don't enjoy it anymore. Looking at a sunset doesn't have pleasure. Looking at a beautiful sunrise, if you like the mountains, whatever. The touch, taste, sight, things that could bring pleasure, they're not pleasurable anymore. So some people don't eat and they start losing weight. Some people overeat because cortisol requires your body to absorb sugar and fat, which are the precursors to a lot of your steroid hormones, like more cortisol, but also estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, growth hormone. These hormones require that. So initially you crave sugar because you need more energy to sustain life at that point. But then as stress continues, grief continues, now you start to crave sugar and fat. So instead of just Skittles and M&Ms, now you want donuts and ice cream. And then in the last stage, your cravings become donuts, ice cream, and potato chips and pretzels because you need salt, because now your adrenal glands are becoming depleted. And those adrenal glands require minerals to support your adrenaline levels. So blood pressure starts to drop. Those are the people with long-term grief. They stand up quickly, they get lightheaded and dizzy because the adrenals can't produce adrenaline as much as they used to. You used up too much adrenaline already and you fall asleep a lot. So you can be listening to an amazing podcast like this one with a riveting conversation, you'll fall asleep because you're exhausted. And anyways, that's just kind of a nutshell, but certainly we can dig into any part of that if you like.
Yeah, the physiological changes you talked about, I mean, I could identify in my own experience a lack of concentration, the inability to sleep. And I craved a lot of fats. I craved a lot of sugars just because of, again, the impact that the cortisol was having on my whole system. Ironically, it took me up until 4 years ago to realize that I needed to do something about my eating pattern. So much, you know, at 66 years old, I decided to go on a path of fitness and a path of eating mindfully. And I feel better almost at 70 years old than I ever did at 35. So
yes,
it took me 18 years to figure that out. And that's why I tell individuals I do bereavement support, when time is relative. As long as you recognize that you have to make these changes when you're ready, and as long as there's encouragement along the way, you'll do it, but you'll do it on your own terms. But yeah, all of those physiological changes that you talked about, I'm sitting there saying, yep, 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 forgetfulness, lack of concentration, inability to sleep. Also, what about our blood pressure and risk for heart attack? Does that go up for the survivors of grief, you know, in the initial like 72 hours or week? Is that a possibility? Is that also a threat as well too?
For people over the age of, I believe, 60, the next day after losing someone, chance of heart attack go up, I believe, over 20%, like 23%, because of the fight or flight response, the release of adrenaline. When that adrenaline gets released, when you grief, you don't know if you need to yell, punch, or freeze, or shut people out. And people respond all kinds of different ways, but those are all fight or flight. And so it makes the left ventricle of the heart beat differently, contract harder. It can cause swelling in that heart. Actually, broken heart syndrome is a very real thing. It's called stress cardiomyopathy. It literally can damage your heart. Grief can damage the heart. It's not just a figure of speech when people say my heart's broken. Literally, it's broken and they need to be cared for and they need some serious care and compassion.
My understanding, is that more prevalent in women than it is men?
It might be, but I'm not sure. I would think so because of their hormone profile being different. But yeah, it's hard to say but that's why in men, I think there's an age range. The highest probability of a heart attack after grief is after a certain age. I would assume it's because testosterone levels are lower at that time.
That would make sense.
And sickness too, and people get sick. The data shows that on the anniversary of your loss, most people get sick.
Yeah, well, and one of the things I know about stress is that it does compromise immune system functioning. More people are more susceptible to colds, the flus, and they're just also naturally run down. So I think the lack of sleep, I would imagine, probably also in conjunction with stress has a lot to do with our immune system being compromised as well.
You're correct.
So the physiological changes that you talked about, how do they impact an individual psychologically?
Well, that's a very good question. It can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. It can be a vicious cycle that feeds itself. The weaker we become, the less likely we are to go outside and get sunlight, the less likely we are to do exercise, the less likely we are to do something that releases some endorphins or dopamine, which can help us feel better temporarily. When you don't feel like being active or doing something, you'll hear yourself say, I don't want to laugh, because a friend of you might come over and say, hey, you know what? Let's go watch a comedy. Let's go to the movies. Let's go watch a comedy. Let's forget everything. For 2 hours, we'll just go relax, watch a comedy, maybe laugh a little bit. And you go, I don't want to laugh. And that's wrong. You have to force yourself to do it. There's certain things you just have to do to counteract that physiology. Otherwise, it makes the psychology worse, which makes the physiology worse. And it's just a downward spiral.
You know, one of the narratives that I bought into in early grief, and a lot of other individuals that I know have bought into in early grief, is that if we experience joy, we feel guilty about that because we're dishonoring the memory of our loved ones. And that's furthest from the truth. If anything, we're honoring the memory of our loved ones by experiencing joy. And in life, you take grief out of the equation, joy, sadness, anything that doesn't represent happiness is going to be part of the emotional experience that we have. So we might as well embrace every part of that and acknowledge that and not suppress it.
And, you know, if I may add, crying is just as important as laughing. Because some people suppress the crying. Let's say they have other children still around and then they want to be strong for their kids or they want to be strong for their spouse. They'll suppress the tears. We can't do that. Crying shifts your body out of fight or flight, increases the parasympathetic response of the body. Healing, repair, regeneration happens when you're parasympathetic. When your body's stuck in fight or flight, immune system, like I said, goes down, so does digestion, so repair does not take place. Crying is self-soothing. Sometimes when you can't fall asleep, if you cry, you fall asleep better. And then there's tears, right? Tears that come out. Well, you know this, there's three types of tears. You got the basal tears, which are constantly being produced to keep your eyes moist. Then there's reactive tears, which is to toxins, reaction to toxins. Like you chop in an onion, you're exposed to smoke, your eyes water. Those are reactive tears. But then there's the emotional tears. The emotional tears help you deal with the cortisol that builds up in the body. They release oxytocin and endorphins in the body. They excrete certain proteins that need to come out. That's a way to get rid of them is through those tears. Those tears have to come out. And endorphins are natural painkillers. So it suppresses the pain that you've been experiencing, which is very real pain, physical pain and emotional pain. It reduces that pain. So crying is very important, and so is laughing.
Yeah, I agree. And almost when the tears flow, it's kind of like we're also embracing and making friends with our sadness. It's almost a relief. And I think tears are cathartic in that way as well, too.
100%. My best friend passed away, and I cried on day one. But then when my father passed away, I didn't cry. 5 years, and I, not that I was trying not to, but 5 years later, I was in the car with my wife. And all of a sudden, I said, I really miss Dad. And then the tears finally came out. So I think you have to grieve your own way. There's no right way. So this is, don't feel like I'm grieving wrong. Just let it be the way it is and handle it and just have some compassion for yourself during the process.
Absolutely. And, you know, crying may be one form of working through grief. It may be sadness. It may be journaling. Our emotions can come out in a variety of different ways. And it's just what works for the person, what they've used in the past, or coping skills or emotional coping skill strategies they've used in the past to cope with trauma and to cope with loss. So that's whatever works. Our job is to kind of be present for that and to nurture that so that they can reengage in life again.
Yeah. And your relationship with food is very critical. And I always say how you eat is more important than what you eat, because it'd be very easy to just neglect yourself nutritionally during that time. And initially, I completely understand. So first few weeks, I mean, yeah, it's devastation. But eventually, you've got to start focusing on your mindset when you eat. So I don't think it's as important to eat really healthy foods. It's important that you're in the right state, physiologic state when you eat. For example, if I am in a car driving, I am late for my next appointment, and I'm on the phone talking to a business associate, and we're having an argument, and I'm stuck in traffic, and it's time for breakfast, and I'm eating something while I'm driving, while I'm talking to someone, while I'm late, while I'm stressed. Physiologically, my body's in fight or flight. It's in sympathetic overdrive. Anything I put in my stomach will sit in my stomach. It won't get digested. There isn't enough acid there to do it. It sits there. It'll ferment. By the time it gets into my intestines, it's not nutritious anymore. I could have eaten the most healthy food of all time, and it'll be poison in my body because the state of mind I was in when I was eating. Now, On the other hand, let's say I've got a very busy day. I'm seeing patients, and we see hundreds of patients weekly. And let's say it's lunchtime, and I only have 9 minutes to sit down and eat. I could try to shove as much food as I can in my mouth and run back to work, in which case I'm poisoning myself the same way I did driving the car in a stress situation. Or what I can do is take the first minute, put my food out in front of me, push play on some maybe Baroque classical music, something that has a nice sound to it, which calms the body, and say a prayer of gratitude. Hey, no matter what's going on in my life, there can be at least one thing I'm grateful for. There's no way there's nothing to be grateful for. Everything could go wrong, but there's always something we can be grateful for. So we focus on that. We say a prayer of gratitude or a thanksgiving, even if it's just for the food that's before us, and you eat slow. Now, 9 minutes isn't a long time, and that's been the case. That's a real example. So 9 minutes later, I've eaten maybe a third of my food. Guess what? It's time to go back to work. But I know what I ate will become nutrition in my body. It'll fill me and suit me the proper way. It'll be the building blocks I need to get through the rest of the day. And I did it in a parasympathetic rest and repair state. Now, ideally, you take a nap in the afternoon. Sometime between noon and 4 p.m., closer to 4 p.m. seems to be better. 10-minute nap spikes your growth hormone levels. Growth hormone is the anti-aging hormone, which helps everything repair and regenerate faster.
And particularly for individuals that are having trouble sleeping in the initial stages of grief, those power naps really, you know, 10, 15 minutes at a time can really be beneficial. And I didn't realize that in terms of, you know, 10-minute nap just stimulating the growth hormone and helping us with the aging process. And that's good information. That's something now that I can also use.
Well, they used to call it a beauty rest. Because
that's
people
right.
Who did it stayed beautiful. Their skin stayed youthful. Now we call it a nap.
Yeah, now it's beauty sleep or power nap. As the times evolve, we have different names for the same things, sexier names.
That's
it all,
right.
It all
that's
means right. The same thing.
Thanks. It's for the type A personality who's driven. They call it a power nap.
Yeah, I like just call it a restorative nap.
That's you know, nice.
That's how I view it.
I like it.
Want to get into a little bit about your books, The Stress-Proof Life and Cracking the Stress Secret. What are they about? What do you want readers to take away from reading them, Amir?
The first one, The Stress-Proof Life, came about because a lot of patients were complaining about stress. You know, stress is the reason I'm sick. Stress is the reason I'm hurting so much. Stress is the reason my marriage is falling apart, all this stuff. And I used to always say, I'm very sympathetic to the stress that you have, empathetic. However, it's not the stress. It's how you're handling the stress. And so you need to train your body to be able to handle that stress. So police officers will wear a bulletproof vest. And so when they wear a bulletproof vest, it doesn't prevent them from getting shot. It just means the bullet won't cause terrible damage. It'll still hurt, but it won't cause terrible long-lasting damage if it hits the vest. And so I called it stress-proof, meaning you're going to get hit by stress all day, every day for the rest of your life. That's just there. But when you wear your vest, it won't hurt you as much as it could. And so I wrote that specifically to my patients, and I gave them what's called, what I used to call the simple seven simple things you can do to make your life more stress-proof. Several years later, we were expanding our business, and there was a time where my father asked me, why are you working so hard? Aren't you afraid that this will hurt your health, affect your health in a negative way? And I said, Dad, you're 100% right. I'm working really hard. I'm working 20 hours a day. This is a season in my life. But listen, just as success is absolutely worthless if it comes at the expense of your health, I believe health is worthless if it comes at the expense of your goals, your dreams, your aspirations. If you sacrifice your marriage to be healthy, that's not right. If you sacrifice your parenting or your time with your children just for your sake of just being healthy, again, that's not right. And if you have some dreams and aspirations to build something amazing or write a book or whatever it might be, and you go, oh, but it's unhealthy to spend 2 extra hours working, that's not good either. So they have to go hand in hand. And what I was telling my dad is, I'm going to figure out a way to have both, to be able to have my health and be able to put it to good use. And so that's when the second book came out, called Cracking the Stress Secret. It's the secret to how to turn pressure into power, because we're all under pressure, but some of us can use that pressure. Ultimately, grief and stress, they're the same thing. They cause change.
So they can cause change in two opposites. They can cause you to lose faith, or they can increase your faith, where you find this level of intimacy with your creator that you didn't have before. They can cause your marriage to fall apart, or it can cause your marriage to be stronger than ever. It can make you become hard. It can harden your heart so you're incapable of love. Or it can make you the most tender-hearted, kindest person on the planet, right? It's how you use it. And so the second book was about that, is let's use stress. So it's just, I came up with 10 steps instead of 7 this time. Similar, it's kind of the rewrite of the first book, but it's for the entrepreneur and the person who wants to achieve things but stay healthy. It's achievement and continuing education and achievement in, hey, I want to have a successful podcast, or I want to have the most amazing marriage and most incredible family on the planet. Whatever you want to achieve, how do you do that and still be able to have health? So I like to talk about simple things you can do. Like, for example, try to get outside in the sun early morning and get some UVB rays. And there's so much power and health in that. Eat with the right mindset. Eat with friends as much as possible. Try not to eat alone. A couple of things you can do to get your sleep to be more powerful. We talk about that. Music is so good for you. There are times you'll hear the first two notes of a song and you instantly get transformed back to your glory days, whatever those glory days were. The minute you fell in love, right? The minute you scored the greatest touchdown and you won the Super Bowl, whatever it might be. You can really feel, you see it at weddings, right? At weddings, you've got this, there's the table with all the arthritic people. They all have their walkers and canes. But when this one certain song comes on, they all jump up and start dancing. The music just made them younger and healthier. There's studies where they put people in cities that are retro cities, meaning like it's a city, when you're in this town, you feel like you're in the 1960s. Newspapers, black and white TVs, the radio plays old music, and they measure their biometrics and biomarkers, and all of them get younger. Arthritis goes away, their posture gets better, their blood chemistry improves, their hormone levels go up, everything improves just because they thought they went back in time to the 1960s. So music can do that for you, and it can happen in an instant. And then moving your body. What if you play that music, stand out in the sun early morning, and do a little dance?
I like it. And any type of dance or movement therapy, I think, is great for the soul. It reduces anxiety, makes us less conscious of our body. The Renfro Center in Philadelphia utilized dance therapy and movement therapy, and it's been proven to be helpful to the individuals or teenagers with anorexia. So there's a lot of therapeutic and music as well. All of that is just good for the soul. It's good for the mind, body, and spirit. So it sounds like we can use stress to our advantage at times as well, too, from one of the takeaways I'm getting from right. Both of your books.
Oh, yeah. Stress is like gravity. I define it as it's a force. It's a force that causes change in your life. So, you know, gravity can cause you to fall and get injured, but it also keeps you from floating out into space. So you can't ever say gravity is good or bad. Fire can burn your hand or cook your food. You didn't say it's good or bad. Money can fund terrorist activity and cause disasters, or it can put your kids through college. You would never say money is bad. You wouldn't say money is good. It's how you use it. I think stress is exactly the same thing.
Yeah, and I think a little bit of stress can motivate us to achieve our goals, to get us moving. A little bit of anxiety and fear can do the same thing. It's just when we have too much of that, when it becomes debilitating, that it becomes an issue. And then
absolutely,
we have to seek the balance that you talk so passionately about.
That's right.
Tell our listeners about Mid-Atlantic Chiropractic Center and how your background in stress management informs your treatment with the patients that come for services.
Absolutely. So we know that there's always stress leads to a syndrome. So it's never one thing. The best thing I can do is give you a little example. A patient comes in, she has neck pain and stiffness in her neck. And what happens is every few weeks, her neck locks up. You know, she'll be drying her hair in the shower and all of a sudden there's a kink and now she can't turn her head. 2-3 days of pain, taking some painkillers, muscle relaxants, it clears up and it's fine, but that happens again. So they want me to make sure that doesn't happen again and cure her of that. And I go, okay, what else is going on in your life? And it turns out she's a school teacher.
middle school. So, you know, middle school, you've got kids that look like they're 20 years old, and you got kids that look like they're 4 years old, and you have everything in between and all kinds of hormones. It seems like that's the age range where all these changes happen and lots of fighting and everything. So being a teacher, you basically have three bosses. You got your students, you got their parents, and you got the administration that you deal with. So that's tremendously stressful. You have three jobs because you have to prepare a lesson, deliver a lesson, and grade papers, three full-time jobs. Three bosses, and you're dealing with a population that's super stressful. So what happens? Every day she goes to work, she's stressed. What does that do? Fight or flight response, right? Blood pressure is a little higher, cholesterol is higher. So I go, what's your blood pressure? She goes, yeah, it's been high. It's borderline, cholesterol borderline. What about blood sugar? Borderline. I'm borderline, you know, pre-diabetic, you know, and I'm on a medication for this and a medication for that. I go, I bet you have constipation too. She goes, yeah, and indigestion. Well, there you go. Immune system's lower. And I said, how many sinus infections do you get? She goes, one a year. I go, well, that's too much. So your immune system's down. What's going on? Well, here's what's going on. Your body's in fight or flight. And I bet you have trouble falling asleep too. She goes, oh no, I take a pill for that. I take a drug and it helps me fall asleep. So that one's okay. I go, well, you know, you should really be able to fall asleep without the pill. And if you're tired, it should be easy to fall asleep. She goes, no, I'm too tired to fall asleep. Well, that's because you're in the wired and tired state of stress. Anyways, so first thing we do is do a detailed digital analysis of the spine, taking x-rays. So we draw lines, make measurements. Misalignments in the neck can really affect blood flow to the brain, can affect mood and physiology. It can affect memory. It can affect, obviously, cognitive functions. And so we take an x-ray through the mouth from the side. Like the angle of the atlas needs to be 14 degrees. Anything less than 14 can cause ADD, ADHD, sleep apnea, insomnia, depression, anxiety, mood swings. And so we want to see if that angle is correct. Through the mouth, we want to see if there's laterality of that atlas, that first bone, because it can affect the brain stem. And then we check every bone in the spine. Also, every misalignment has a sympathetic response to a varying degree. So if it's a big misalignment, major sympathetic response, small misalignment, small sympathetic response. Either way, it's pushing people into fight or flight. So we correct the spine. That includes post x-rays to make sure we did the right things. And then after that, I give them breathing exercises. Exhale is parasympathetic. Inhale is sympathetic, right? So if you sneak up behind me and scare me, the first thing I'm going to do is gasp. It's an inhale, right? Now, if I find out, oh, it's Dave. He's just playing a joke on me. The next thing I do is breathe a sigh of relief, right? Listen to what that sounds like. Sigh of relief. That means a slow, long exhale. So if you count to five when you breathe in and count to 10 when you exhale, and your exhale is twice as long as your inhale, you will normalize that biorhythm. In fact, that's a good cure for insomnia. If you're trying to fall asleep and you can't, do a slow inhale, count to five, make sure you count to 10, make sure it's exactly twice as long as the inhale. 10 of those breaths twice a day shift your body out of sympathetic. So those are some of the things we teach them. I teach them to be grateful when they're eating, to make sure they're in the right mindset. I tell them about short bursts of exercise. They don't have to go to the gym for an hour a day every day if they don't want to. They can go for a walk in sunlight and that'll help. But things that'll bring you out. You know, the secret to longevity, this was in a study. They said that the people who live the longest has nothing to do with how they exercise or how well they eat or any of that. It turns out they have one thing they look forward to every day. So as an example, there was an older lady who enjoyed reading. So she always had a great book with her. And every day at 4 p.m., she would make herself a small cup of tea. She'd get a small pastry and she'd sit somewhere that she enjoyed, like in her sunroom, in her house, with her book. And she would read for 15 minutes. And every day she looked forward to that. Well, she lived past 100 because that kept her going. We need to have something we look forward to every single day, no matter what's going on in our lives.
Exactly. Something to keep us engaged, something to give us meaning, something that, like you said, we look forward to, because I believe research has shown that the more engaged we can become and interested in life, there's a positive effect on our longevity. And I think there's a lot to that.
Absolutely. And a very close second to that is how we nurture the relationships in our lives. Because again, on our podcast, we reported on an article called Superagers. I think it was published in the either New York Times or Washington Post. And superagers were people in their mid-80s who have perfect memory. They remember everything. They don't have any cognitive loss whatsoever. Their minds are sharp. And they said, well, what do they have in common? And the article went through, do they exercise? Well, no, not really. Some of them do, some of them don't. Do they eat well? Some of them do, some of them don't. Do they smoke and drink? Some of them do and some of them don't. There was no correlation for any of those things. And bottom line, they said the only thing we found that may be a possibility of why they were able to keep their mind sharp and not lose their memory is because they had really good nurturing relationships with their loved ones. They spent time with the people they like and their memory stayed sharp. You wouldn't think that's the case. You would think, oh, they must have eaten a lot of antioxidants.
Or a lot of Prevagen.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think relationships, community, I think it just keeps us alive. It keeps us active. It keeps us interested and it keeps us sharp mentally. Along with doing other things that challenge our minds, which as I get older, I try to think of different things to do to keep my mind active. So
good for you.
Now, you mentioned your podcast. That's Real Health. Am I correct?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about your podcast, how it aligns with the mission of Mid-Atlantic Chiropractic.
I want myself, all my doctors, my staff, I want us to all be up to date on the latest information in health and wellness. So we regularly find articles, we share them with each other, we read them to discuss them. And one day we said, hey, we could just turn on a camera and record this. So now it's called the Real Health Podcast with Brandy and Amir. What we do is during the week, we look for articles and topics, whatever's in the news, mainstream media, whatever people are talking about. And we bring those articles, we read them, we highlight them, we summarize them, and we discuss it. Sometimes we argue, sometimes we agree with each other, and then we give advice. So our purpose for the podcast is to help our listeners feel better, get stronger, live longer, and feel younger.
And boy, that sounds like it aligns with the objectives of your chiropractic business as well, too. So that's great. I'll make sure that the link for the podcast is also in the episode notes along with your other contact information.
But I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. One of my last questions for you today is if you're going to leave our listeners with one thing, and you've left us with a lot, one ultimate takeaway for today, what would that be, Amir?
You know, I would just reiterate something I said earlier today, which is stress can destroy you. Grief can destroy you. It can destroy your life. But if you're cautious and careful, it can actually improve your life. There's nothing good about grief, obviously, but why don't you use it? Is it possible to use it? Is it possible to use it to become a better person? Is it possible to use it to honor, like you said, the memory of the person you lost? Is it possible that that person can look down on you and say, wow, I'm really proud of my dad. I'm really proud of my mom. You know, that they're doing such amazing things. You know, it can strengthen your faith. It can strengthen your relationships. It can strengthen your ability to love. I think I heard this in a movie. The movie is called Courageous. When you lose a loved one, like a child, it's like having a body part chopped off and you never stop missing that body part. If your right arm is torn off and you don't have that right arm anymore, it's not like you're going to be happy about not having that arm. You always miss that arm, but you learn to live without that arm. And then you learn to use your other arm a little bit better and a little bit more. And then you can set an example for others. You can change the world around you. You can let grief change you in a negative way, or you can use grief to change you and the world around you in a positive way.
Absolutely. And you're right. I think it is a choice that we can choose to handle our grief any way that we see fit. And even if the consequences are negative, it's the free will that we have as human beings that allow us to make those choices. But for me, you know, with all the grief that I've experienced in my life, I have chosen to transcend it, strive for acceptance, not closure, but strive for acceptance of the fact that my life is going to be the way it is without the physical presence of my loved ones, and be willing to make a difference and reengage in life regardless of the circumstances. And I think that's what we can strive for. I don't stop missing my loved ones, but they're a part of me now. They're a part of everything that I do. And I move forward with not only their memories, but with the best characteristics of who they are to try to reengage in life to the best of my ability, or until God or the creator, whoever we share higher power is, calls me to my next existence. So thank you for that, Amir.
Of course. You know, every time you hit record on this podcast, you're doing it for that person.
Absolutely.
Every time you share what you just shared, you're doing it for them. And you use it to bless so many people and bring hope to them, because then they go, hey, Dave can do it, I can do it. And maybe I can use this grief to inspire others.
That's right. And listening to the tools that you have to work with individuals under stress are going to listen to this and say, hey, maybe this can work for me. So, you know, it works both ways, Dad. I think as podcasters, it's important for us to create a platform where other people's stories can come out, their talents can come out, so that we collectively can contribute to the betterment of the world in general. And I think if we can do that as podcasters and as individuals who are committed to service like yourself, the world's going to be a much better place.
100%.
And we're going to leave the world a better place than we found it.
That's the goal.
My last question for you, Amir, is people want to get in touch with you, purchase your books, find out more about your podcast. What's the best way for them to do that?
So books are easily found on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And our office website is midatlanticclinic.com. There's a way to request an appointment if you live nearby. There's ways to message me there. Emails, obviously, you can certainly call the office. The phone number's on the website. And then my personal website is drrashidian.com. And there's a little more information about what we talked about today on that. And then our YouTube channel is called Real Chiropractic. And our podcast is on that. Our podcast is also on Spotify and iTunes and everywhere else also. Our YouTube channel has a lot of other videos that, you know, I share information on. So that would be a good resource as well.
Yeah, and I would encourage my listeners, if they're interested in improving their overall health and managing stress, check out the resources that Dr. Rashidian has. They're plentiful and they're useful and there's something for everybody. With that, Amir, thank you so much for being just a wonderful guest contributor to the podcast today. I truly enjoyed our conversation and I hope we can do it again in the future.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.